I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE after Friday's scheduled visit to the White House by Zelensky, or as Donald Trump calls him, the dictator of Ukraine. Zelensky, after seeing maybe a million of his people killed, has now officially signed away a defeated Ukraine's resources to the USA. All this after fawning visits to Trump from Polish, French and British vassal state leaders who run countries without freedom, according to US Vice President J.D. Vance. To mark the third anniversary of Russia's move to liberate Donetsk, Kharkiv, Kherson, Luhansk, Mykolaiv and Zaporizhia, the USA and Russia voted at the UN against puppet countries like Britain, France and Germany. Much of the world appears united against an economically suicidal European rump of Eurasia, now prompted to slash social spending and pour money into warfare. The country of Hamlet, Denmark, suggested peace was more dangerous than war, and Britain's Keir Starmer signalled sending most of the British army to de facto fight Russia. All this while West Asia tried to cope with an AI video posted by Trump depicting him and Netanyahu cavorting over the bones of the Biden genocide in Gaza. In Moscow again is the former lieutenant colonel in the Soviet and Russian armed forces, Dr. Dmitry Trenin. He's on Russia's Foreign and Defence Policy Council. Lieutenant Colonel, it's so good to have a Russian on the show after so many people from the American side. You know, we had Trump's deputy assistant on the other day, Sebastian Gorka. So, I mean, Trump has been saying off and on, it's possible there is some presence of Western European NATO troops allowed in Ukraine. And, of course, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, has said no. So what will happen to these soldiers if they turn up there? I mean, right now, there are MI6 there and British special forces in Ukraine. What will happen to these troops if they turn up there?
Well, if they happen to come without Russia's approval, which is not forthcoming, as we see, they may become targets for Russian strikes. And that would involve those countries into a direct and immediate military conflict with the Russian Federation. I hope that the rulers of European countries consider that seriously before it's too long, before it's too late.
But you've been seeing what's been coming out of the mouths of these European elites, increasingly unpopular with their own populations in recent weeks. They clearly see Russia as the enemy. They believe Russia has designs on London and Paris. And they seem to think that by even separating from the United States, they can take on Russia.
Well, I'm not quite sure of the last thing you said, because the presence of European forces in Ukraine, hypothetical at this point, was predicated by European leaders on the support of the United States. So in the hour of need, those Europeans would want to have American backing. This is something that President Trump is, at least for now, unwilling to extend. And I don't think, frankly, that this position of the American president will change. But we've seen so many reckless moves by the Europeans during this war that essentially made them almost direct participants in the conflict. And there have been words of warning directed at them by President Putin last year when they were on the verge of supplying Ukraine with long-range missiles. And those missiles indeed were supplied, although they were used more or less in the war zone, not striking much deeper into Russia in most cases. But I do not trust European leaders personally with making serious decisions about military matters. I think that many of what they decide upon is reckless and laden with lots of risks for their own countries, and that is a cause for much concern.
Clearly, based on their words, people like Sir Keir Starmer, they're not worried, they're not frightened of the Russian nuclear deterrent. But then if Moscow is able to trust with verification Washington to a certain degree, and of course there's a timeliness to this. What's the point of any signed agreement if European leaders continue to be the way they are? Or does the Russian leadership and the Russian government think that Europe will fall in line as they normally do as puppet states of Washington? Because at the moment, they seem to be at odds with Washington, and there is that rump of Eurasia between Russia and the Atlantic Ocean and the United States.
Well, I think that at the end of the day, the Europeans will have no alternative but to side with Washington or follow Washington. They don't have resources, they don't have the will for an independent security policy, an independent foreign policy in the true sense of the word. And the absence or presence of American backing for their risky, potential risky moves in Ukraine is critical for them. So I think that they will rather not challenge Washington on that issue, because Washington will be put in an uncomfortable position when and if European forces are deployed in Ukraine, and then they their locations and their bases are engaged by the Russian forces. Washington will face a very difficult challenge or dilemma to respond and involve themselves, America that is, involve the United States into a war, a real war with Russia, or abandon its European NATO allies. A choice that President Trump certainly would want to avoid.
Yeah, clearly there is talk of withdrawal of US troops, occupying troops from Western Europe, but Trump is wielding a degree of leverage against, certainly economic leverage against these Western European countries for other reasons. Russia, though, and we've been covering on this program over the past 3 years, was paying Zelensky for the rent of the pipeline usage for gas into Western Europe, and is supplying energy still to Western Europe. When is Russia going to sanction the countries of Western Europe?
Well, I wouldn't bet on that. Europe may eventually sanction Russia and completely cut off those member states of the European Union that are still getting their gas from Russia. That would be a risky move in terms of the integrity and unity.
Sorry to interrupt there, but presumably itself. It buys it off the black market then, because it needs the energy. It can't supply it all. Right, the United States can't supply all of it. They have to, they're desperate for Russian energy.
Right.
They finance the Russian war, in fact, London, Berlin, and Paris.
Well, let them say what they want to say, but Russia does need foreign exchange. And it has been argued very openly in Russia that cutting off gas supplies to other raw material supplies to the rest of the world that end up in Western countries would not be a smart move by Russia. So yes, there is a certain degree of inconsistency in this whole thing, but we're dealing with a very, call it a strange war or a war with unconventional features. There's no war declared in Ukraine. The diplomatic relations have not been officially broken, just there are no embassies in the two countries. And of course, relations between Russia and Europe that are in a proxy war situation, or the United States for that matter, have continued throughout the 3 years of the war.
Yeah, it's not that strange for the working classes of Russia, though, is it? They've been killing Russians, and these are European weapons. So when the new Chancellor of Germany says he wants to send the new Taurus missile, he means aiming to murder, to kill Russians. That's the whole idea. And a lot of these Russian parts, Western European parts, are there to actually target inside Russia rather than the battle lines.
Well, that is true, and in my view, strikes deep inside Russia by European or with European missiles, and if we know that such strikes cannot proceed without the support of the nations that have provided those arms. So they are essentially, their finger is on the trigger, figuratively and sometimes literally speaking, and that that calls for retribution. And there have been voices in Russia, many voices, persistent voices, that argue that Russia should not be only targeting those Ukrainians that are formerly in charge of those missiles, but pay back to those forces in Europe that are behind those arms sales, those arms deliveries, and that intelligence delivered to Ukraine that enables the Ukrainian forces to strike into Russia.
Yeah, that never materialized, which is presumably why London, for instance, is not frightened of Russia. It continues to talk up war and the mass killing of Russians as a kind of duty. But I'm not sure these Western European nations can actually launch things without the American satellites in the sky in any sense, any other way. They don't have the technology, arguably. But how isolated, then, is this Western European area? I mean, we saw Russia and the United States voting the same way at the UN. How isolated do you expect Europe to be? And that's why I kind of said maybe Russian sanctions on Western Europe would be not seen as out of place, given most of the rest of the world appears to think Western Europe is the only thing standing between Russia and Ukraine and a peace deal.
Well, I think it's still too early to say that the United States has completely changed its course on Ukraine or on Russia. Yes, we have seen that unique case of the United States siding with Russia against the European Union during a major vote in the United Nations. Yes, we've heard some vibes coming from the White House that suggest that the approach may be changing, but we're not there yet. And there's a lot of uncertainty about the future moves in U.S.-Russian relations and future moves in U.S. policy toward Russia and U.S. involvement in Ukraine is also something that that is subject. It's subject to change, or it can preserve some of the elements of the old approach. I would say that we need to be a little bit cautious when we sort out what concrete changes have been wrought so far by Donald Trump and where he may go yet from now on.
Dmitry Trenin, I'll stop you there. More from a member of Russia's Foreign and Defence Policy Council after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with a former director of the Carnegie Moscow Center and now member of Russia's Foreign and Defence Policy Council, Dr. Dmitry Trenin. Dr. Trenin, you were expressing caution at the end of part one about Trump policy vis-a-vis Russia, Ukraine. I mean, I've got to ask you whether, in the light of fears, clearly, that he's pursuing some sort of imaginary Nixonian line, amidst that, is that because the Trump administration doesn't really appreciate the times of change and the detente between Beijing and Moscow can no longer be split apart like Richard Nixon did?
Well, I think they've learned also from Trump's first stint at the White House that a frontal attack on the Sino-Russian relationship would yield few, if any, results. So they're likely to get smarter this time, but surely they believe in the White House today that it is to a large degree the fault of the Biden administration that took on China and Russia simultaneously that Beijing and Moscow have been able to forge a fairly close relationship. For Trump, it's no longer the game of ideologies. It's no longer the collective West united by liberal globalist ideology taking on the quote-unquote authoritarian East with Russia and China at the fore. They look at China and Russia as two separate entities, and they want to pursue different policies to reach American objectives in each case.
Except, sorry to interrupt for that, except for all the transactionalism of the Trump administration, he was clear about BRICS, and he clearly expressed a desperate fear in the early days after his inauguration of any move away from the use of the dollar. So he's very aware of a new world order that is emerging.
I think he is, but the move away from the dollar is something that is happening in Russia's relations with a lot of countries simply because Russia has been barred from the global dollar-based financial market. And Russia has been using national currencies. It has been using the ruble in its business transactions with a lot of countries, and even that is often the problem, including in Russia's relations with China. With regard to a common BRICS currency, I don't think we are anywhere near that.
Yeah, but isn't that the point? Russia wasted its time. Putin wasted the time that was available to the Russian Federation to speed this process up, because right now, none of those BRICS countries are going to want to oppose the United States or be seen to opposing the United States by turning to non-dollar trade, because they'll be subject to 100% tariffs.
Well, that's true. But it's also true that even before Trump, there was fairly little headway that was made in that direction within BRICS. China, with its enormous volume of trade relations with the United States and the European Union, is certainly not interested in risking its position in both those giant markets by doing something that would be seen as inimical to the dollar, inimical to the existing financial system. Similarly for India. So it's the relations within BRICS are interesting, but it's not always that the member states of the group that has expanded recently, that that members of the group see eye to eye among themselves with regard to the major economic issues and financial issues. So we're talking about within BRICS, we're talking about payments instruments. We're talking about making payments systems work in the situation when one of the major members of the group, i.e. Russia, is essentially ejected from the global financial structure.
Yeah, but that's an advantage, arguably. And that would be arguably an excuse. I mean, it sounds like incompetence that during these 3 years, this arrangement wasn't sped up. So, I mean, what you're actually saying, I suppose, is that Trump has bought a new lease of life for American hegemony, perhaps even allowing to make the mineral deal with Russia over the contracts for preferential mineral rights in eastern Ukraine, which you'd normally have thought Russia would be making a deal with China over the acquired territories of Ukraine.
Well, Trump has changing is changing the model of American hegemony. He's not canceling American hegemony. He wants it to be more efficient. He wants to cut spending. He wants to subsidize America's allies.
In fairness to Trump, that's not hegemonic power. That's a multipolar world, as spoken about by Russian politicians. It's just that Russia hasn't been up to the mark.
Well, Russia is what it is today. We can sometimes, in our thinking, imagine that Russia is the Soviet Union incarnate. But the Soviet Union was accountable for about, some people say, one-fifth, and others one-sixth, one-seventh of the global GDP. Russia is nowhere that point today. The Soviet Union had a mighty industry that turned out lots of goods of different varying quality, but many of those goods were fairly good. And it had a major technological complex that put Soviet science and technology close to the top of the world. We are in a different position today. We're trying to do better. We're trying to win back the technological sovereignty that the Soviet Union had. And I think that the war has pushed us much further than we otherwise would have been able to cover toward our goals.
Yeah, by PPP, but, you're ahead of Germany.
Not imagine that somehow we're bigger than what we are.
Yeah, by PPP, though. And that seems to be the new indicator, rather than notional GDP, arguably. What about all these 93 countries, vassal states around the world that didn't catch up in time for that United Nations vote and seem to be still voting with the old colonial masters in London and Paris? Will it take time for all the vassal states all around the world to understand that there's no need for the Russophobia anymore because their masters at the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, I don't know the future of any of these multilateral organizations, they want peace now, unlike this isolated Western European portion of the earth?
Well, you said vassal states, in today's world, of course, there are only a handful of countries that can truly enjoy sovereignty. And even that sovereignty is only partial. Many of the countries that you have mentioned, or let's say many within the 93 that you mentioned, depend on one way or another on the Europeans. Some would still depend Many would still depend on the United States, including the Europeans. But the United States, at this point, has not tried to make sure that all its vassal states would vote with the U.S. The United States did not lean hard on the Europeans, did not give an order to its vassals, to use your language, to make sure that they aligned themselves with the new American position. The United States has just changed its own position and is arguing with the Europeans about the wisdom of that position. So it's not as simple as it sometimes looks. Also, let me underline one important issue. Many of the countries within the BRICS group, including China and India, did not vote with Russia on that very important issue. The Chinese and the Indians abstained. They have their own reasons why they abstain on that, but they've always been abstaining on that issue. Probably because the issue of territorial integrity, national sovereignty, inviolability of borders is an issue that resonates very much in their own countries and their own societies. But the truth is that the countries whom you would include normally among Russia's best partners and friends are still taking a neutral stance on that very important issue, very important for Russia.
Yeah, I presume President Xi and Prime Minister Modi tipped off President Putin about that. You did get Ortega of Nicaragua, it should be known, as well as the president of Eritrea. What happens, and are the Russians preparing for not only in 4 years' time when Trump goes, But if Trump is killed, there have been assassination attempts already, because so much of it seems to revolve around one figure who is dismantling this so-called deep state in the United States, which has tried to destroy democracy all around the world so that it opposed Russian interests, Chinese interests, interests of the global
South. Indeed, it's remarkable. It's truly remarkable, the sheer power of one person in the U.S. There was a joke 30-plus years ago when the Soviet Union first introduced the position of a president. And a Russian journalist said jokingly that the title of the president of the Soviet Union was as absurd as the title of a Tsar of the United States of America. But Donald Trump, just, 5 weeks, 6 weeks after his inauguration, has behaved more like a Tsar in America and, very interestingly, has not been much opposed. There have been a few court rulings and there have been a few statements by state officials in the U.S., but otherwise it's been more or less running without very little opposition within the United States. If something happens to Trump, of course, the American Constitution provides for the vice president to take over. In that sense, the assassination of Trump prior to the election would have knocked out a mighty figure, a mighty political figure, leaving a void in his place. Today, if something, God forbid, happens to Donald Trump, he will be succeeded in due course by J.D. Vance.
Dimitri Chernin, Colonel, I'll have to stop it there.
He is a fairly formidable figure in his own right.
Colonel, I have to stop it there. You'll always be General Secretary to us. No, thank you very much, Colonel Chernin.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That's it for the show. We'll be back on Monday with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft's Professor Anatole Levin. But until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.